You are listening to Keystone Stock Talk Show, episode 248.
If this is your first time listening, then thanks for stopping by. This podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at www.keystocks.com. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Keystocks and on Facebook, and keep submitting your stocks via the usual social channels or at our website, keystocks.com, for our Your Stock Our Take segment. And we just might review your stock in an upcoming show and let you know if it is a buy, sell, or hold.
Okay, it's great to be back. Ryan is not going to be in the podcast today, or it's possible that he will be jumping in at some point, but I'm going to be hosting in his absence, as he is in New York City right now at a conference talking to probably about 1 to 2 dozen different companies. So yeah. We still have a great show planned for you today. I'm going to kick things off with a discussion of one of the newest entries to the public markets. This is Trump Media and Technology Group, symbol DJT, Donald J. Trump. This is a company that just started trading via a SPAC on March 26th. When it first started trading, the stock went wild and the market cap went up to roughly around $8 billion. Since then, it's been pretty much a steady slide down. So I'm going to take a look at the company. I'm going to look at the financials, discuss some of the reasons why the stock is trading the way it has. Is it worth the current $6 billion market cap? Or is this a company that is going to be disappointing to investors over time? After that, Brennan is going to jump in. When we did our 2024 predictions, he predicted that Tesla would have a poor year in 2024 with a sliding share price. So Brennan is going to review his prediction. And then after that, Brett is going to talk about what place cash has in your portfolio. So typically when we look at the asset allocation equation, most people think stocks, bonds, even alternative investments, but cash also has its place. So Brett is going to discuss how much cash an investor should look to put in their portfolio and reasons why a cash may be a required asset. Excellent. Okay, so gentlemen, do we have Ryan or do we not have Ryan? I've heard mixed information from him, whether or not he's going to be here.
He's going to ruin our flow if he does show up. So
I'm sure.
We know that for sure.
Which means he will definitely be showing at some point in time. Ryan, are you there? There is no Ryan.
Chosen there, but he's not there.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. We'll be able to manage without him, I think. So
yes,
pretty stacked show today still, even with only the three of us. There's going to be a few things that we discussed to begin with. What do you guys want to start with?
Yeah, I guess probably start with the poll there, Brent. Yeah.
We go through the poll from now, I guess, a couple weeks ago. So we asked, what is your primary self-directed broker? Either a large Canadian bank, so TD, RBC, and so on. They came in at 43%. Or an online-based broker within Canada, so Questrade, Qtrade, Wealthsimple at 45%. Or an international / a foreign broker at 10%, or other at 2%. So there's, I think, one person voting other, whatever they happen to be.
Yeah, I was kind of interested to see the results. I personally use Questrade. I enjoy it. But we actually, we did a segment in our April webinars, which I went over the different self-directed discount brokerages in Canada, like including the big banks, a couple of the online only brokers, as well as one of the international brokers, which I think, you know, is a really good takeaway just as I kind of go through the different commissions and account fees and, you know, what broker supports which Canadian registered accounts, because there are some, you know, especially the international, that will not support an FHSA, for example, or whatnot. So I thought that it was a pretty interesting a poll just to kind of get an idea of what our listeners are using. And just kind of as a FYI as well, clients do now have access to that webinar in their accounts, the recorded version from April 2nd. So check it out if you're interested. And if you aren't a client, you can still register to our April 11th webinar, which is at 7 p.m. Eastern. So again, April 11th at 7 p.m. Eastern, if you want to catch out, catch my self-directed discount brokerages and obviously a lot more segments as well that we go over.
But would you consider that the centerpiece of the DIY?
Yes. No, of course not. Of course not. No, this was actually my first time actually being a part of the one of the DIYs. So I would say that it's definitely a secondary part and not the main part. But yeah, I thought that it was pretty good. I know that Ryan was asking me after I got off. He was, you know, he asked me, how did it go, Brennan? I said to him, I blacked out. I can't remember. You know, no, it went well. It went well. And yeah, I was glad to put the content together. I enjoyed because, I mean, good. I was even learning myself as well.
Well, yeah. And for those of you that don't know, twice a year, so in the spring and in the fall, we run DIY seminars. So this is, we've been in the markets, researching companies, making recommendations for 25 years. This is a 3-hour seminar that essentially teaches people how to build a 20 to 25 stock portfolio, talks about the current system for building portfolios and what's wrong with it, with respect to the way the big banks want to do it, big bank financial advisors and actively managed funds. So how can you manage fees? How can you take control of your portfolio? We talk about, as Brennan talked about, you know, accounts, different types of registered accounts, non-registered accounts, how those fit into your portfolio, as well as, you know, what we look for in a stock, some exciting themes, how 2 to 3 stocks can really be transformational to your portfolio. So a lot of great content. And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to take the most important lessons that we've learned over the past 25 years and condense those into a 3-hour seminar for people. So we did our first spring seminar. So we do 2 every run of them. So 2 in the spring, 2 in the fall. We did our first spring seminar last week. And then the next one, which is the last one for the spring of this year, is, as Brennan said, on the 11th. So we were sold out last week. I believe we're very close to being sold out for the current week. So if you are interested, go to keystocks.com and buy yourself a ticket.
There'll be a link in the description as well.
Perfect. Perfect. Excellent. Good. Good. So Ryan right now is at an investment conference in New York. I think, is it the Planet Micro?
I think it's the LD.
Oh, and it's the LD. Sorry, it's the LD. Yeah. That's right. The LD conference in New York. So he's going to be talking to a lot of companies out there doing some face-to-face meetings. But he actually went about a week early, or tried to get to New York about a week early with his family to take advantage of the trip to New York, and didn't work out too well. They ended up being, I think, as he said, they got 30 minutes from New York. They had to turn around due to weather. They landed in Montreal. They left their house at 5 in the morning. They were stranded in the Montreal airport. They had to, they left for a hotel. They had to spend the night. I think they were in the airport until midnight. Then they came back the next day, delayed again. I think it was 2 days they were delayed in Montreal and had to spend the whole Correct. Time in the airport. And the second day they were going to fly back out, that's when the earthquake happened in New York, and that never happened. So that delayed them again. So not great luck, but I think they finally made it. They did eventually make it, and hopefully they had a good time. I haven't really spoken with them about it, but.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear his colorful words that he's going to use about Air Canada. And, you know, I know that he was saying that they ended up reaching out and saying, oh, we'll give you 20% off for your next flight. And, you know, he's almost, you know, he didn't even like hearing that. Of course, you know, it was he spent, you know, I think it was something like 10 hours in the plane on the tarmac, basically. And, you know, now he gets a little bit of what I get flying in and out of Saskatchewan. But I mean,
well, I think Brennan was delayed for like 2 hours or something when we came back from Los Angeles, and he was basically in tears from what I heard.
I was crying. And same thing with Ryan. Ryan was calling me in Montreal. You know, he called me in Montreal, absolutely crying on the phone. He was like, "Book me a hotel, Brennan." Just kidding.
All right, should we get into things here?
Let's get into it.
Okay, so I'm going to start off with a very topical company here, and this company is Trump Media and Technology Group. So one of the newest entries to the public markets. I just started trading via a SPAC transaction March 26th. So only less than 2 weeks ago, as a matter of fact. So Trump Media and Technology, well, this is Trump's media and technology company. The sole asset is Truth Social, which is Donald Trump's private, essentially his private social media platform. After he got banned from several platforms in 2020, he made the move, I believe it was in 2022 that it was launched, to have his own platform, which he wanted to market towards, you know, more conservative people or people that were in his sphere of influence, essentially, and wanted to hear what he had to say. So as I said, they just became public in March via SPAC transaction, trading right now under the symbol DJT on the NASDAQ exchange, stock price of $36.40. It's a $5 billion market cap. Quite a wild ride so far. So March 26th, they start trading. They did a merger with Digital Acquisition Corp, which was a SPAC. So we've talked about SPACs before. This is just basically an easier way for a lot of companies to go public as opposed to doing a traditional IPO. Generally speaking, we find that most of the companies that use the SPAC structure aren't necessarily the highest quality businesses. That's why they need to use it. Of course, that's not always the case, but it generally tends to be a higher risk way of investing. Now, right after it started trading on the first day, the stock price shot up over 50%, and the company reached a valuation of about $8 billion. Since then, it's pretty much been straight down, dropping from a price of about $65 down to about $36 in change today. So what's going on here? Well, you know, the first thing that we always like to do when we're looking at a business is we want to take a look at the financial performance of this company. As I said, it had hit a $8 billion valuation market value, shortly after trading. Right now it's down around $5 billion. So the company did on April 1st issue its financial statements for the 12-month period of 2023. So this is for Trump Media and Technology Group, not for the SPAC. And the company, Trump Media and Technology, reported revenue of $4.1 million for the year. So $4.1 million, that's primarily from advertising revenue from the Truth Social platform. Truth Social is really the only asset of the company right now. So $4.1 million in revenue for the year and a net loss of just under $60 million. So $58 million net loss for the year. So minimal revenue there. Quite a bit of cash burn. Now, just looking at the balance sheet, taking a look at what the company has in terms of assets and liabilities. So they ended the year with cash of about $2.6 million. And the company does have debt. There's convertible promissory notes. There's long-term lease liability. Convertible promissory notes are about $42 million. In total, you're looking at about $45 million in debt. And then negative shareholder equity of $66 million. So financially, the stock leaves a lot to be desired. But really, you know, we want to take a look at True Social and just get a sense of what is the value of this social media platform. So one of the best ways to do this is to compare it against another social media platform that, you know, is similar size. So we've decided to pick Reddit. Reddit has a market capitalization of $7.3 billion. So fairly similar to Trump's company right now, Trump Media, which is $5 billion. When Trump's company first started trading, as I said, it was up around $8 billion. So they were almost on par at that point in time in terms of market capitalization. So how do these two social media platforms really compare? Well, one way that we would look at a social media platform is based on monthly active users. Now, True Social actually doesn't report their active users or their monthly active users, which is unusual for a social media company. That's generally a pretty key metric. But doing the research that I've done, there's a range of estimated monthly active users for True Social. And this ranges between about 600,000 to 2 million. Now compare that to Reddit. just under 870 million monthly active users. Revenue for True Social, as I said, 2023, 4.1 million compared to Reddit of 850 million. So if we were to look at this on a price to sales valuation metric, True Social is trading at a whopping valuation of almost 1200 times sales. So this is an insane valuation if we were in fact to value it on revenue, which clearly it is not being valued on right now. Now let's compare that to Reddit, 9 times sales. If we were to look at, say, Meta, Facebook, they're about 10 times sales. So that's generally a valuation multiple based on sales that we would want to see. 1200 times is just absolutely astronomical. Now, another way that I've done a valuation here is price to active monthly user. So for every active monthly user, you're essentially with True Social paying about $3,850. Now compare that to Reddit, about $8.40. So obviously, you know, something is going on here. $5 billion market cap based on, you know, the size of the platform, True Social, the financial performance. It's really confusing as to like what would justify a valuation at this level. So if I'm going to look at this just purely on a financial valuation basis, I would say that Trump Media and Technology is a complete and utter dumpster fire. I mean, there is almost no value in terms of financial performance to be had there. So what is going on there? What's happening that is justifying this $5 billion market capitalization right now? Market capitalization that was very recently $8 billion. Now, the easy answer here would just be like, well, Donald Trump has a cult-like following, right? So all of his followers see that he now has a public company. They're rushing out to buy shares in that company to prop that share price up. I mean, really, True Social has been around for, you know, 1.5 to 2 years now. So it's not like you can really expect any organic explosive growth in the user base based on, you know, normal conditions right now. So one would think that it's people that love Donald Trump that are running there and buying the stock. And I definitely think that there is an element of that, but I also think that it goes beyond that, right? So Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, right? So what actually happens if he is elected president, right? He's not on Twitter. He's not on Facebook. He's not on any of the other social media platforms. He just posts on True Social, okay? And I'm not going to get into the whole polls and like what is the likelihood that he will be successfully elected president. But I would say that in almost any presidential cycle, you know, the percentage that it goes to either candidate isn't that far from 50-50, right? So maybe it's like 60-40, but nobody can say that it is or isn't going to happen. It usually, to me, is a bit of a toss-up. So what happens if he is actually successfully elected president? That means that he is potentially going to be doing all of his social media communication through True Social, right? So anybody that wants to follow what the president of the United States is saying on social media is going to have to use True Social. That includes people in the United States, foreign dignitaries, press. You could imagine the user base would absolutely explode in that situation. And you could take it further. I mean, as president, he may dictate that, you know, the executive branch of the US government has to use True Social as a social media platform, right? And he may say that, you know, other platforms like Twitter and TikTok are, you know, not going to be used by the US government. Now, I'm not sure if it would go that far, but you could even take it further and say that he could use the office of the president to attack other social media companies like Facebook that he certainly does not like. Now, I know Twitter, he is allowed back on. So he is not banned from Twitter anymore. He has chosen not to go back on Twitter, I believe because he's contractually obligated to just focus on True Social. But if he wants to use the office of the presidency, he could essentially do his best to handicap other social media companies for the benefit of his own, right? Now, some people will say, well, wouldn't that be like a massive misuse of power and conflict of interest? And the answer is yes, it absolutely would, which in no way would stop him from doing it. So this is the thing. I think that some people are actually looking at this company based on the speculative upside if he is elected president. And maybe the chances of him being elected. I mean, I'm not going to get into the stats. Maybe they're 50, 40, 30%. They're not zero, right? They're not 10%. They're probably not 20%. They're probably better than that. And if that happens, you know, you could actually see this thing move up. Now, would I suggest buying it? Absolutely not. I think, as I said, it is a complete dumpster fire of a company when you look at the financials, particularly compared to the market valuation right now. I would not go close to it. If he loses the election, I think this thing is going down like 95% plus the day after. It's probably going to move up and down a lot through the election cycle based on what the likelihood is at the time that people think of him actually getting elected. But I wouldn't short it either, because it actually makes sense from a very speculative perspective why some people would actually be buying it. So that's my analysis. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, so I actually brought up to Brett today because I was like, dang it, I should have shorted it. You know, that's what I said to him. And he said, well, you actually have to look a little bit deeper, Brennan, because like for example, if you want to short a stock, like the short seller needs to borrow the stock from an existing long only investor. And where like for like normally, you might be charged, you know, a few annualized percentage points.
It's normally not even that.
Well, exactly. To be honest, I'm actually reading a Forbes article right here in front of me, which I should probably disclose that. But, you know, that's what they're saying here is, you know, generally it's a few annualized percentage points. But and Brett brought this forward to me, which I didn't know. The cost to borrow Trump Media is currently set at an annualized rate of 550% for existing short sellers. And according to short sale data provided by S3 Partners, new short sellers need to pay as much as 900% annualized interest rate, which is a new record, to short the stock. So,
that means a lot of people are shorting the stock. Yeah. That means there's high demand to short.
Exactly. Right? And this is, you know, like the Forbes article is saying here, this implies that for a new short seller, the stock would have to drop by about 2.5% per day just to break even. Mm-hmm. So again, like you guys said, of course, you know, there's not many short shares out there.
Another way to look at it is I actually have the numbers up. It's right now you're paying 267% interest rate, but that fluctuates a lot.
Yeah.
And right now outstanding, this is off Interactive Brokers, there's around 50,000 shares available to short. Yeah. There's 133 million shares currently in their float. And normally when a company has that amount of float, unless it's a heavily shorted stock like this, you'll see probably 10, 20% at least available short at any time. And if the short interest rate starts to go up, you'll normally see more become available short because people will actually buy a long position just to lend it out when it is like this. So you do get these big fluctuations just because of the short market dynamics. And that could be what you're seeing over the past week as well, past just the initial speculation.
But no, it's a
so
great
just
point.
Generally speaking, I mean, I'm far from an expert on the mechanics of shorting because I generally just think that shorting is a stupid proposition, just as a general rule of investing. I mean, when you're going long a stock, your upside theoretically is unlimited. You can make 100%, 200% or more. I mean, we've seen companies, you know, Hammond Power up, what is it up? Probably about 16,000% right now, right? It's the upside is unlimited. Whereas when you're shorting a stock, the downside is limited to 100% less whatever you pay in fees, right? So it's just, there's an asymmetry in terms of risk return there. So it's not, it's not a proposition that I think is
smart. And as well, just on that is, you might be thinking, oh, well, then I'll use options. That high interest rate is baked into the option prices as well, just so you are aware. It's not a one-time, it's not a get out of jail free card when you're buying options compared to just direct short selling. We baked into it to some degree. It's not always one-to-one and people will actually arbitrage that, but it's not a simple solution that's catch-all by any means.
Great. Okay. Well, let's move on from that and we will go to Brennan. You're going to talk about Tesla and how it's performed since your prediction.
Yeah. So I'm probably going to jinx it here, but I'll take a look. So during our 2024 prediction show back in January, at the beginning of January, I predicted that on an absolute basis, Tesla would decline during 2024 from its current price of, or then current price of $256.50. And this was based on Number one, Tesla's profit margins declining as the company was reducing the price points of its vehicles. Number two, high interest rates impacting EV demand with expectations for 2024 to be modest. And finally, you know, we are just seeing significant competition coming in from Porsche, Mercedes, etc. So right now, my prediction is in the money with the stock down about 32%. I think it's actually 30% right now to around $173 or $175. And let's go over a few reasons why the stock is down. So the company reported its Q4 financial results on January 24th of 2024, which was just a few weeks after we did our 2024 prediction show. And looking at the results, revenue growth for the year continued to be strong, up 19%, but it did slow considerably from the 51% growth achieved in 2022. And at a first glance, the company's profitability appears to be up 19% to $15 billion. But if we look a little further, there was actually a $5 billion benefit from income taxes for the year. So if we adjust that tax benefit out, net income is actually closer to $10 billion, and basic EPS is around $3.15 per share, which is a decline of 20% from 2022. So after making the adjustments to 2023, net income margin down there is closer to 10.3% for 2023. For 2022, it was around 15.4%. And 2021, it was again 10.3%. And one of the partial reasons for the decline in margins is due to the decrease in prices of its models, with the Model 3 base down about 17.5% from 2023. The Model S base, the price of it's down about 27% in price, and the Model X is down around 34%. And while Elon decreased the prices of its models to try to maintain the growth in deliveries, last week Tesla reported a Q1 2024 deliveries miss of 386,000 vehicles, roughly, which compares to analyst estimates in Q1 of 2024 at approximately 449,000 deliveries. Oops. There we go. So now that I am taking my slight victory lap with the stock down 30% from when I made my prediction, we all know that just because I'm bringing it up on the podcast, the stock is probably going to go up to $300 per share by the end of the year, making my prediction wrong. So I'm probably jinxing it here. But in all seriousness, I think that 2024 will continue to be a difficult year for the business, especially with elevated interest rates and consumers more hesitant to go out and finance a new vehicle, which, you know, could potentially present an opportunity for those who like Tesla long term. So, you know, if you are looking at the business, definitely keep an eye on the financials to see what they do over the year here. And that is my short but sweet segment.
You know, I think that increased competition is always something that I wanted to keep an eye out, or advise people to keep an eye out when it comes to Tesla, because there was a time when they were literally the only option for people that wanted an electric vehicle. Just even looking at, say, Toyota's Q4 results, electrified vehicle sales were up 96%, representing 41.6% of the company's overall sales in the quarter. So that was 24,533 units. 16,600 were fully zero emission vehicles. The rest were hybrids. And that's just one company. I mean, there are other auto manufacturers that are coming out with their versions as well. So now Tesla has to deal with a lot of competition. There's also like the cool factor of Tesla, right? I mean, when not many people had them, it was a major status symbol to have one. You know, now not as much. You see them around a lot more often. So it's I just think that it's going to be a tougher move forward for them.
Yeah, like I was even watching like a YouTube video of like a traveler in China, and they were talking to people about the EVs and Teslas in China. And at least, again, this is very anecdotal because it was one person, and they were basically saying that, you know, if you were to buy a Tesla in China, not that people look down on you, but just they see as the BYD, which is the leading EV company in the world right now, they see the BYD vehicles as way superior, or again, at least anecdotally from this one individual. So, you know, we are seeing a lot of competition around the world, and especially as, you know, Tesla is trying to, you know, continue to enter into that market more and more. But anyways, that is my segment.
Great. Excellent. Well, we'll see, and see how you end up at the end of the year.
Just so you know, he's already jinxed it because he was mentioning he was already going to do this on last Friday, and we're recording this on a Monday, and it's up 4.9% on Monday.
Oh, it's over.
So he's already jinxed it.
Yeah, this is true. I got a little bit of wiggle room, but a
little bit of wiggle room.
A little bit. We'll see.
Okay, great. So we're gonna listen to Brett now here. He's going to explain to us why cash is king, or if cash is king.
Cash is sometimes king, sometimes not. It's all about the nuance here. So we got a question, and this is a generally a pretty common question you'll get, is how much cash you should hold, how much of a percentage of your portfolio, and really how often should you rebalance it. They specifically ask cash in a climate of reduced purchasing power and increased money supply. How much cash as a percentage of total portfolio should one keep? Should you rebalance once a year? A person's age, is it a consideration? So we can really break this down into a few factors. So what is the percentage of cash you want to have? What's the rebalancing frequency, and as well as the age? And I'll add as well into that, what other considerations should you consider as well? All these factors interact with one another and may change depending on market conditions, but you can generally get a good idea once you look through really your own considerations. So first, the few considerations I want to go through. Age is the biggest one, but it's not as much about age, about where you are in your investor life cycle. This is an image from Investor Capital, but you'll see many, many articles on this online. So when you're initially investing in your 20s or 30s, you have a long time horizon. You're starting to accumulate wealth, but you also have some big expenses like houses coming on that you'll need to purchase soon. And then in your later years, you might have some kids, but you also have a higher income at that point, so you can really reinvest in that point. And then in retirement, you're starting to draw down on the wealth which you accumulated during those prior periods. So it really depends more where you are in your life cycle. Are you planning to retire early, late? Do you have kids? No. It's those types of considerations where you actually are in your actual life and not just strictly your age. So, but how much cash you want to have really comes down to foreseeable or planned expenses and unforeseeable and unplanned expenses, which age can give you an idea of, or your investment life cycle where you are in it. So for foreseeable expenses, they include big expenses. I'm not just talking routine daily expenses, which would really be coming from your income than out of your income. So these expenses are like buying a house, kids' university tuition, effectively really any sizable planned expense. It could be a large vacation, something like that as well. If you have larger expenses, the more cash you'll need to hold, obviously. Further, the closer that expense is to you. So if you are planning on buying a house today or within the next month, obviously you want a higher cash position than if you were planning to buy a house 10 years from now. Because if you hold a cash for a longer period of time, you're effectively giving up returns for that extra safety in the short term, which when you're looking in the long term, you don't want to inherently do that. So in other words, if you're buying a house 10 years from now, don't be holding cash for it. You should really be invested more into risky assets, and it should be effectively 100% when you're looking at that allocation in respect to your house. But the other type of expense is really unforeseeable, unplanned expenses. There are things like medical expenses, which you don't expect, non-routine maintenance of household repairs. So if you break a window, if Brennan's throwing rocks at your house again, that's when you will have to obviously have an increased expenses, stuff like natural disasters as well, auto repairs, that sort of stuff. Things which you can't either expect when they happen, and even if they do, you may not know the amount beforehand. So you really just have to plan for those things, but you can't completely eliminate it. Sometimes you have insurance for these, but even that, if you do, insurance might not pay out right away. So you always want to have at least a bit of cash on hand to cover your short-term expenses, because if it is something like a tornado or a catastrophe insurance scenario, it might be months or even a year before you get that money, or even longer in some cases, depending on exactly how it is. You'll need to budget for that and really just check on how your insurance and insurance policy and so on is what you should be looking at there. So therefore, but past that, you really want to set cash aside for about 6 months to a year of normal routine expenses. You need to budget for this, and you can check against your actual historical expenses to get a rough idea. And then as well, you want to add in a bit of a buffer to that as well, because whether prices are changing and so on. So 6 to 12 months is a good baseline of routine expenses, which you can use as a baseline. So then on top of that, you'd add your foreseeable planned expenses with those unplanned expenses plus the routine expenses. And therefore, you'll get a ballpark figure when you divide that by your total portfolio. It would likely be in the range of anything between 2 and 20% of your total financial wealth. It really depends on the person a lot. So don't really pin yourself to a percentage of a target of your total portfolio value, as this will change over time with your expenses, your portfolio size, and so on. So don't think of it as a straight percent. It's so for some people, it might be a bit easier to think of it in absolute dollar terms or in terms of months of expenses. So you want to hold between 6 and 12 months of expenses, or you want to hold $20,000 or so on, instead of I want 5% of my portfolio, because that has a lot more factors in it, because that includes your investment as well. So it might be simpler when you're looking at your short-term cash needs as a dollar amount instead of percentage. And I will caution here as well, holding cash is actually a risk as well. Holding too much cash is a risk, because on average, it will get a lower return than effectively every other investment, particularly if you look at risk investment stocks or so on. So if you hold too much cash, it may put your retirement plans at risk, because you aren't able to accumulate as much wealth over time. So someone in like me in my 20s, if I'm holding cash now, realizing about 4% over the long term, even less than that for long-term bonds, compared to an average 8, 9, 10% return on the stock market, when that's compounding for the next 30, 40 years, that is just a substantially massive difference in growth. And you really don't want to over-index yourself into cash just because you see it as, oh, it's less risky. It can actually produce more risk in the long term because you're foregoing that growth in your portfolio. So another type of cash you may end up having is really transitory cash, is what I'm calling it. It's cash you have from selling off another investment. For whatever reason that might be, it might be it hit your target investment, it might be it's underperforming actually. Whatever that reason happens to be, you sold the investment, you have cash on hand. You generally want to minimize this, as it creates that cash drag. It has a lower return inherently. So you want to generally reinvest that as quick as you can. But at the same time, you can use this as an opportunity to reevaluate your cash holdings. Does it still meet your current expenses and so on, especially if it's a larger amount? But as well, you don't want to rebalance constantly. You do not need to, especially when it comes to cash, as it should slowly be increasing. On the chart I have on screen, you can see the percentage change. But every year, that has a 4.5% increase. And I just put some arbitrary, realistic numbers into the risky investment returns there. And you can see it goes up and down. But every year, the cash is increasing. So if your expenses and your planned expenses stayed the same, that's fine. The percentage doesn't really matter here. It's really just the actual dollars in isolation that you really need to pay attention to whenever you're looking at that transitory money, if you need to top it off. And as well, you don't really ever need to re-add more cash into this once you have that initial emergency fund in there, as it should just slowly be increasing with interest rates. So unless you have increased expenses or something like that, where your plan actually changes, that's the only time you really need to actually top it up. So if anything, you are lowering your cash by reinvesting it into other assets, less likely so than raising it unless you get an unplanned or expected expense. And as well, perhaps one of the things which people overlook a lot of the time when they're holding cash, especially a retail investment, is when we say hold cash, we don't mean you're just putting a cash in account that a checking account that has no interest or anything. You should be holding in cash equivalents or cash-like investments. So these things can be like ETFs, treasury bills, short-term treasury bills specifically. You're looking at normally a 3-to-3-month one. It will be a baseline for that. As if you're just holding in a checking account or even a standard savings account these days, you're generating effectively nothing. And as long as if you're not going to need that cash literally the day of, you can invest into some different assets. We have an entire report on it. It is about 6 months old now, but we will be looking to update it as well. And these things, it will go over things like ETFs as well, the treasury bills, then investment savings account, which is different than a normal savings account and allows for a bit higher return. But then there's risk and reward trade-offs with all these types of investments. And you should really look into what might fit in your scenario. And really just to drive the point home, if you're holding in any of these, you're getting around 4.5 to 5% interest every year at the time, because it's always based on the short end of the curve. So if you hear interest rates are going up or down, these rates will change along quite closely with it. It's very closely tied to those rates. Versus if you're holding in a checking account, I personally get zero, and I think the savings accounts right now are about 1 to 2%. So you're getting, if even a half of the percentage of return holding in one of these versus these more new types of investments when it comes to like cash ETFs or investment savings accounts. So really look into these if you're looking to have an emergency fund or any type of cash holdings in your account. Look into it, because at least then you can get something out of your cash and just, instead of effectively 0%. But yeah, I don't know if you guys have any comments there.
Like, one thing that I would say, it's a great example with, like, you know, upcoming expenses in someone's life. For example, like, look at my own situation. I opened up an FHSA. I'm looking to potentially purchase a home within, you know, the next 2 years or year here. Well, that FHSA is sitting in one of those cash ETFs, essentially, because I'm trying to keep it liquid to, you know, potentially move on the purchase of a home. So I think that is a great point that you made, Brett. You know, and even looking, you know, how much cash should you hold? Well, you know, short term could be potentially how much expenses that you have, or maybe some, you know, have an emergency fund for a certain percent or a certain amount of expenses that you that may arise. For example, like your car breaking down or whatever. You know, I do know, like, I do listen to Dave Ramsey sometimes. And again, I agree with some of the things he says and some of the things I don't agree with what he says. But generally, I think he preaches like about a $10,000 emergency fund as well. But yeah, no, I think that you did a good job there, Brett.
Yeah, when you look at standard portfolio theory, when they say, oh, you know, 6 months of expenses or whatever, most people, I mean, sure, in a perfect world, most people aren't going to be able to do that. It's just unrealistic. But, you know, having some cash squirreled away for an emergency is not a bad idea. You know, what that number is going to be is really going to depend on what the family situation looks like, and also the capacity, more so even the capacity. But one of the things that I always say to people is that we talk to a lot of investors. Everybody is so widely different, right? I mean, we can talk to two investors that are the same age, have the same size stock portfolio, and two completely different investor profiles. So there are different reasons to hold cash. I mean, you know, sometimes it just comes down to, I made, you know, a good return. I liquidated, I took some partial profits on a company that I did really well on. You know, what do you do with the rest of that cash? Well, if you're an individual stock investor, it might make sense to be patient with how you deploy it. But no, that's good. I mean, at least now, you know, in the past as well, in terms of what to do with the cash you have, we've always just said, well, you may as well just put it in the bank, because, you know, money market funds, GICs are not paying anything. At least now you can actually get a return, which is, so there's something to talk about. And that's the reason why we put together the cash report that Brett had shown. Excellent. Okay. Well, I think that does it for this episode. We managed to survive without Ryan. Things actually went according to schedule for once. No, we'll see Ryan back again next week. But just want to remind everybody, we have our last DIY seminar for the spring series this Thursday, the 11th, April 11th, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 Eastern. So Brett's going to post a link to that. You can also go to keystocks.com as well. If you don't subscribe to the channel, subscribe right now, put down a comment. Maybe there's something you said that we said you agree with, something that you don't agree with. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have any stocks you want us to review, send them in for a Your Stock, Our Take segment, and we'll take a look at that. And we may be able to review it on the show. So that'll be good for now. We will see you all next week. Thanks a lot for watching, and profitable investing.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.